Something wicked is coming this way, and only fools are ignoring the signs. So it's time you became a financial prepper like thousands of others. Gold can travel anywhere. It's international. It's its own currency. Allocate to gold now, the timeless safe haven asset. Open an IRA with Noble Gold Investments to physically hold coins and bars, and let real, tangible gold, not just paper, save your portfolio as the economy burns again. Right now, Noble Gold Investments offers a free 3-ounce silver American Virtue coin with every qualified IRA. Just use the promo code GOLD to claim your free coin and secure your family's financial future. Go to NobleGoldInvestments.com now. NobleGoldInvestments.com.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
RPN is not responsible for the views, actions, statements, or opinions of its guests, advertisers, or even its viewers. The information contained in this program is not to be construed as medical or legal advice. An appearance on this platform is not necessarily an endorsement, but as always, we encourage you to do your own research. Enjoy the show. My guest, G. Edward Griffin, and I will be back in just a moment, so sit back, relax, and grab your popcorn. We'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back to the program, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And please join me in welcoming our guest for this evening, Mr. G. Edward Griffin. Ed, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Zach, for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Excellent. And I would just like to give the audience first an introduction to you. I think it's unlikely that they're not going to know who you are, but you are a storied author. You're a producer of many films and projects on video. I would like to know, first of all, how did you begin this journey, researching these topics, exposing the communist overtaking of America, getting people to know the truth about what's happening behind the scenes?
Well, Zach, that's probably going to be a very disappointing answer and a boring one, because it's nothing dramatic about it. You know, nothing came along. It wasn't like a Groucho Marx show where the duck comes down and the bell goes off and, oh, I'm on the journey. No, I think it's like most people's lives. We wind up ending up not where we started off to go. It was never our original goal. Little changes here and there that we go off 30 degrees and then back and then 20 degrees the other way. And all of a sudden we're going 90 degrees and our career unfolds before us. So we think, how in the heck did we get here? That's kind of what it was with me. I was a very typical person, young person coming out of the system. I went to the public schools. I learned what they indoctrinated me with, and I didn't question anything because they were the teachers and the smart ones. And I read their books, and so I was totally programmed into a materialistic world. without much understanding of really how the world works. Slogans. I was raised on slogans. You know, America is a place of home of the brave and the land of the free. Good slogan. And I think it used to be that way. And there was plenty of evidence that that was correct. But the evidence came pretty much from history. The current evidence was that everything was going to pot, even though we were living very well and a lot of money around and all that sort of thing. So I was kind of a materialistic guy and never thought about anything much outside of myself. And then I decided it was time to get married. That's what you do when you're, when you know, you reach 21, you got to get married and have kids and have a family. So I looked around. I wanted to find the prettiest girl on campus I could. And I found her. And of course, she married me. And so that was according to playbook. And then that's how I was going. I wound up in Los Angeles. By the way, I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, in that general area. Wound up in Los Angeles because, well, I decided I wanted to make a big career in Hollywood. Well, that didn't work because there were a lot of people there in Hollywood with much more talent than mine. I had worked in a television station as an assistant director, which means I was a floor manager, pulling cables and throwing cues and that kind of thing. And then I'd worked my way through the University of Michigan, making money there as a radio announcer in the local radio station WUOM. And then I went to Los Angeles to splash in Hollywood. Well, I went thud, of course, because there was so much talent there, better than mine. And most of these poor kids, like I was, were all had these stars in our eyes. And all these great, talented people were serving table. They were waiting and washing cars, waiting for the big moment, you know. And a lot of them were getting into the drug world, and it was all glitter and fame and fortune. And so I'm glad that I didn't qualify for that, because who knows, I might have been pulled into it. But so I got a real job, and I had to raise my family. And so I had to earn some money. I went through all my savings and got a real job with a large insurance company doing, mostly analysis and installing health insurance programs for companies that insure the employees and so forth, group insurance policies. And so I was in the corporate world, climbing the ladder, was making a good splash. And I thought, well, I'm going to the top of this corporation, because all the really big hitters above me in the corporation, most of them were very old. There was a big gap there for some reason. And I figured in about 5 or 6 years, all these vice presidents would be retiring, and they have to reach down into middle management. And that's, I figured, aha, I had it all figured out, see? And then something happened. Now we get to the answer to your question. What was that one thing that got me off of this materialistic path that I said, how am I looking? Am I in the right neighborhood? I've got the right car. I've got the right wife. I've got the right number of kids. I got a station wagon and a dog. I got everything. What else do I need? You know, I got off of that when I walked into a client's office, and my appointment with the president was, I think it was 2 o'clock, and I was there about 1:15. I was pretty early, so I had nothing to do but sit in the waiting room. And normally you would look around for a magazine, you know, a sports magazine or something about yachts or golfing or something that's supposed to appeal to the masculine mind. And there was nothing there except one little magazine, sort of Reader's Digest size. It was called The Free Man. It was published by the Foundation for Education on Irvington on Hudson in New York. And it was dedicated to the principles of free enterprise and laissez-faire government. I had never seen such a thing before in my life, not in the grade schools, not on the university level or anything. So I picked it up and started to read it, and I was blown away by the article I read. I won't bother going into it, but it was a very simple analogy of how some salesman comes into a little village in a beautiful part of the world where the sun shines and there's no pollution and the water is pure. And everybody's happy, the plants grow and everything. But the salesman comes in and he has to sell them. His product was the oil lamp. Nobody wanted an oil lamp. What do they need that for? They go to bed when the sun goes down. They get up when the sun comes up. They till their, you know, the crops and everything. And you got to have this lamp because then you can work later into the day and into the night, and you can read books and you can educate your children and so forth. Oh, well, that's a good idea. So people started to buy lamps, and of course the lamps spewed out black smoke, and everybody had to have a lamp to keep up with their neighbors. First thing you know, the sky was no longer clear anymore. It was filled with smoke. Now they really did need lamps, even in the daytime, to see to see through the black smoke. And so they ruined their lives by accepting a false solution to a problem that didn't exist. And the analogy was made quite well, that this is how government works. This is how politicians work. They're the salesmen that sell you things that are bad for you and tell you that they're good for you. And if you fall for it, you wind up, but now you do need these political solutions. I thought, isn't that interesting? So I kiped one of those magazines. There was a stack of them, all the same issue. So I figured they were there for me to do that. But I took one and looked around, didn't see me, and I put it in my briefcase. And it was a terrible thing to do, but I did it. And I took it home and I devoured it. And I subscribed to the magazine. I became hooked on this type of literature. And I bought all the back issues, even got the bound editions of them. I still have them in my library, bound volumes of these back issues of the Free Man magazine. Well, that was the little step that got me thinking out of the pattern. Now, that wouldn't have done it. That was no such big deal, except now I'm kind of a budding libertarian. I'm thinking about things from that perspective. And then I run into another pamphlet written by some college professor in the Midwest. I never heard of either him or his college. But it was a critique of the United Nations, a very strong critique. And, well, I knew that was garbage because I had studied the United Nations in school, and I knew that it was our last best hope for peace. And it was a wonderful organization. Was good people in New York were concerned about curing diseases among the downtrodden third world countries, and they wanted to educate everybody and bring everybody to the peace table and put an end to war and everything. I knew all of that. But this pamphlet, it upset me because this professor had some interesting quotes and statistics and some facts that went contrary to that. So that shook my inner brain a little bit. And I went to the library, which I never thought I would do again after I got out of school. Who would want to go to the library? But I went to the library to see if I could confirm some of these things that this professor had said. And I got the books out. I looked at it. I looked up the stats. And by golly, he was right. So that jolted me. And this was the one that got me off the path of thinking, well, maybe the deterioration of society was just one of those cyclical things in nature that happens, you know, every couple hundred years. Empires grow, then they get soft, and they fall. They're conquered by somebody else. And we've all read the theory of the cycle of history. Well, when I was reading the Freeman information only, I got the impression that's what was going on. It was our turn to go through that historical cycle. But then when I started reading this other stuff, I said, no, this is not historical. There are people out there making this happen. There are people out there encouraging this deterioration of society. They wanted to destroy society so they could build their own version of it. I could see that. So that's when my crusader gene started to rattle. I didn't know I had one. And for the first time, Zach, I started thinking in terms of things outside my own world, started thinking about the future, thinking about my children and my grandchildren. And what about my fellow countrymen? And what about everyone in the world? What kind of a world are we going to live in? I didn't know I had an interest in those things until I saw material evidence that those things were under attack. So that's when I really got crazy. I quit my job. I had a great job.
That takes
job.
A lot of bravery.
Well, it took a lot of stupidity, my wife thought. And and she said, how are we going to put food on the table? We have to have an income, you know. I remember so clearly. I said, don't worry about it. It'll work out somehow. And so that's what I did. I quit my job, and I started to give speeches. I knew this. I studied communications and speech in school, and I was in that field more or less. So I thought, well, at least I could talk on these topics. So I booked myself out as a young guy who gave speeches on things like the United Nations, for example. And I was very popular. A lot of people wanted me to speak. and their local communities, the Kiwanis Club, and their PTA meetings and so forth. Primarily, I think it's because I was a free speaker. I was call me up, I come and speak. And that during that period, I decided this is not going to work. I can spend the rest of my life going from group to group to group and talking to people in their living rooms and talk to maybe 30 or 40. Big audience would be 60 people every night for the rest of my life. I would barely scratch the surface of reaching the real population. I realized that we've got to make this, we've got to use some of the communication technology that's out there. So that's when I decided to try and produce some very low budget documentary films. I'm giving you more than you probably wanted to hear.
No, this is perfect. It's perfect.
Okay. So I thought, well, I know how to produce documentary films. I think I studied it and never really produced one, but I read about it and I participated in pieces of it. So I thought maybe I can take these topics that I am giving lectures on and make them into film. So that's when I launched out of the big business ventures. I had a little stack of business cards from people who had attended my lectures, and they liked the lectures, and they gave me their business cards, and they said, you know, if I can help you in any way, let me know. So I had all these cards. I thought, they want to help. So I sent them all letters and said, well, I want to produce a film on this topic or that topic, and I need some money, and I don't want a donation. Well, I want to form a little of a partnership, a venture, and I want you to invest money. We might even make a buck. I didn't think we would, and I told him that. I said, we probably will lose our shirts on this, but who knows? We might make some money, and at least you could write it off as a legitimate tax deduction and do a good job besides. So blow me down. If people came forth, they would send me $1,000. One lady sent me $2,000. It was amazing. And I think our budgets for our films were, I think, about $12,000 for a two-hour documentary, which was mostly me speaking, unfortunately. But anyway, that's what we did. We produced some film strips. And finally, oh, by the way, everybody made money on those films a little bit, not much, except for one. And that one broke even. So nobody lost a penny on any of those ventures. So I was very happy about that.
That's great.
Okay, so then... So here I am. I'm producing these low-budget films, and I decided that I wanted to produce a film on inflation. Inflation, well, that's an interesting topic. I didn't know too much about it, except that I knew there was something fishy going on there. Why would the dollar have held its value for so many years, rock steady, and then all of a sudden it started losing its purchasing power? And I had read some opinions about it. Somebody said, well, it's the bankers, it's the Federal Reserve, it's the creation of money. And I thought, creation of money? How do you create money? Well, they throw you in prison if you create money, and you're not allowed, you're not the government. So that's where I was, you know. So that this would make an interesting documentary film. So I did some research. I filled up a couple of banker boxes with books and reports and magazine articles on every aspect of this. And I never did produce the film because other things came along that were seemed more timely and were easier to do. And then now I'm moving forward in this narrative and coming to an end pretty much. I got a call from a little old lady in Pasadena. Now, we've all heard about the little old ladies in Pasadena in tennis shoes. They live in those big mansions in Pasadena, and they're widows. And they have very expensive cars in their garages, which they don't drive. Well, this was one of those in every way. She fit that bill. And she had a study group, she called it, that met once a month in her home. And they were looking for a speaker on the topic of taxes. And she heard that I could give some speeches on interesting topics. And would I be able to do that? And I remember saying to the lady, well, I don't know much about taxes, except that they're too high. Mm-hmm. And I'm against them. Other than that, what can I tell you about taxes? And I said, aha, I remembered my banker box is full of material. I said, I could give a talk on the hidden tax. And she said, hidden tax? What's that? Well, you'd have to come to my lecture and find out. I said, great. So, of course, I was talking about inflation. Mm-hmm. It is a hidden tax. Mm-hmm. And so I told her it was about inflation. And she said, oh, that would be wonderful. So that, okay, I did the speech. I've got these banker boxes out. And I opened up them. I went through all the material. And said, oh, my gosh, this was even more more significant than I realized it the first time I went through it. I guess I was still too green at that point to appreciate what I was holding in my hands and how important it was in other aspects of the this battle for liberty and independence. Anyway, so I got really into it by this point, and I worked hard to put together a little quick and dirty speech on it. And at the end of this presentation, there were, again, about 50 or 60 people there. I remember this one gentleman came up and he said, you know, he said, that's pretty interesting. You should put that on the road. Well, that's the worst thing he could have said to me, because I thought, wow, I could put this on the road. So what did I do? I put it on the road. I started to promote that I was offering a one-day seminar, and I called it a crash course on money. And all of a sudden, that caught a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody wants money. They want to know about money, and they think they know at some level that they don't know anything about money, how it comes into being, how it loses or gains its value, what's good money, what's bad money, who's responsible, who makes the decisions, none of that. So I gave this course lecture called Crash Course on Money, and it was very successful. We sold out in every case, and now we didn't have just 60 people. We'd have like 250 or 300 people in that range. Well, this is a lot better. We're gaining on it. And so that's where I was, and until finally another little old lady, she was not from Pasadena, but she was similar. She, at the end of one of my crash courses, she said, well, Mr. Griffin, and that was funny. Here she's a beautiful little old lady, probably in her 80s or late 70s, and she's calling me Mr. Griffin, you know. I think I'm probably about 30 years old or 32 years old like this. She said, Mr. Griffin, she says, I need advice. She says, you know, I'm a widow, and we don't have a lot of money. I have the insurance from our policy, and it's invested in a couple of small apartments, and I'm in debt to do that, but I'm making a little bit of cash flow on it. She said, what do you recommend? Should I sell that and get out of debt? Should I go into gold and silver? What should I do? Should I... How do I protect myself from this continuing inflation? What is a good investment today? And I looked at her, and it was like she had stabbed me in the heart, because she exposed, with that question, she exposed the fact that I was a fraud, because I had no idea how to answer her question. I was so wrapped up in the banking mechanism and the inflation mechanism, I couldn't answer her question. In fact, I was thinking about some of those things myself. How should I do it? Mm-hmm. And I told her something. She was satisfied. And but that's when I stopped giving those lectures, and I enrolled in the College for Financial Planning in Chicago. It's a home course, but it's similar to a course that people take to get their CPA designation, you know. Mm-hmm. And this one offered a recognized designation as a certified financial planner, CFP designation. Okay. Now, I did that not because I wanted to become a financial planner, but because I wanted to learn about the real world of markets and investments. And so I went through that. I got my designation. I never used it, but I've got it on the wall someplace, on some other wall. And that's when I realized what I had hold of, because I realized that just about everything that was in that course was built on a foundation of lies. And there's no way in the world that if that's all I knew about money is what I learned in the course, there's no way I could have given good advice to anybody. I would have been setting them up to support the system, mm-hmm. but they would have all been vulnerable, and they would lose their asset values and everything, and they would lose at the end of the process in most cases. So I thought, this is terrible. Somebody's got to do it. There went my crusader gene again. Mm-hmm. That somebody's got to take this information, which I had accidentally acquired, and tell the world about it. That's when I decided, how do I do that? I guess I better write a book. So that's how The Creature from Jekyll Island started. And now to wrap this all up, and that's pretty much the end of the story, although it continues in that vein.
Of course.
You see, I'm going from one place to another. I'm winding up in places I never thought I would be there. I'm the last person in the world to write about money and banking. I mean, my, what do I know about money and banking? You know, and I'm going to write a book about it and face some of these college professors that teach courses on it. They're going to cut me to little pieces and spit me out, you know, like little pieces of chewing gum. Never happened, of course, but I was afraid that it would happen. So I'm the last person to do that. But and I would never have started down that path, Zach, if I had known then what lay ahead, you know, because there were too many challenges and too many things where I came to a place where I can't go beyond this. This is beyond me. I've chewed off more than I can swallow. So, but nevertheless, I stuck with it. And I think many people have asked me, how long did it take me to do that? And it's a hard question to answer because I was doing other things along the way to keep the proverbial food on the table.
Sure.
I couldn't just stop everything. But I think if I took all the hours, days and hours that were spent on that project and put them together, it would span a 7-year time period.
So this roughly takes us to what, the early to mid 1960s at this point. And the world has really changed since then. You know, at that time, America was entering into Vietnam. We had this kind of era of prosperity after World War II and then moving into the countercultural revolution. How has the work you've done changed in terms of how society has been receptive to it? As people moved into that that countercultural revolution, do you think that they were more receptive to learn about what was happening behind the scenes, like the true machinations of America and the financial markets? Or do you think that it's become more difficult as a result of what we saw in the hippie movement?
Well, that's one of those questions where I think the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
Because they're both trends, I think, at work, and it's hard to evaluate which is the stronger, if there is any answer to that one. But let me take the part that is easy, which is that I've never changed my interest or my approach to the things I do, except I hope I've learned some lessons along the way, and I'm doing it more efficiently now than I was in the beginning. Other than that, My aptitude or my interest in things like that are always the same. For some reason, I don't want to deal with the minutia at first. I want to get past all the details and say, let's clear that out, see what the foundation is. That's a hard way to describe it, but I'm always looking for the big picture first. And I never knew how important that was. It was instinctive, that's all. And so many people, if not, I'll say most people, are not interested in that kind of an analysis. They don't want to know about, well, it all began back with Adam and Eve, you know. Mm-hmm. They want to know how. So let's start with the last election, mm-hmm. and that's all they're interested in. So those people are not usually attracted to my kind of work. And that's too bad. I regret it, but I say in the comfort of my privacy that, well, they wouldn't do anything about it anyway, because if they don't understand the foundational issues, they're probably going to be on the wrong side. Even right. though their hearts and their instincts are correct and they're good people, they're going to be easily fooled. And if they're not willing to understand the foundational issues, probably we're better off just steering clear of them, because they can't help us. We have to help them if we can. So the counterculture thing was kind of a mixture of both of those. I think most of the, as you call it, the hippie types were introspective people. They wanted to know about foundational things. Mm-hmm. But the media primarily, and other forces outside of the media that were well-financed by some of the tax-exempt foundations and all that, were making it easy for them to pick up on slogan-oriented ideas. And of course, the New Age and the Age of Aquarius and everything is supposed to come from the sky or the alignment of the planets or something. And we're all going to be at one with the universe and we'll sing Kumbaya. That was, I believe, deliberately infused into it to act like a magnet and pull a lot of people out of a productive action program to do something about the world,
yeah,
just to get them off the track, so to speak, and onto a siding. So it was very hard, if not impossible, for me to reach the Kumbaya people. And by the way, there's still plenty of Kumbaya people out there.
Sure.
And they'd rather, you know, they'd rather go to India and study under a guru who will tell them that everything is okay if they just learn how to say Om, you know, something like that. And it's a very appealing thought. You smoke a little pot, I suppose. It begins to make some sense. So, but those are not the people that we're looking for. So I don't even think much about them, except too bad. Maybe somehow they'll break out of that pattern. But now for the really serious people, that's where it gets tough, because the serious people are more skeptical. And I could talk all day, and they'll listen to me and they'll say, like I would if I were them, they say, well, that sounds interesting, but I don't believe it. Prove it. Show me. Where's the evidence? I don't see any evidence, because they're all looking at mainstream media,
right,
and haven't yet come to the realization that mainstream media is a barrier to evidence. Mm-hmm. It's a filter. They don't believe that either. So that you start with that handicap, because their sources of information are polluted. And you can't just say, you know, you're dumb, not because you're stupid, but you're dumb because you haven't had facts. They don't want to hear that. That sounds like criticism. But it's the truth. I mean, I think, except for some accidents of history, like walking into that store and buying that pamphlet, or into the guy's office and picking up the other pamphlet, except for a few accidents like that, I might be in the same category. I don't know. It's quite possible. So the intellectual, let's call him that, the one that thinks internally a lot, introspective type of person, can be the hardest person in the world to reach, and also the easiest person in some cases, because they want to know deeper than on the surface. I still run into that all the time. I welcome the hard-nosed ones, because that's the way they should be. I'd rather talk to somebody that just says, I don't believe you, man. Mm-hmm. You know, where do you get that information? I love it when I hear that, because I've got the information. That's a lot better than the other one that says, well, you can show me the information, but it's probably not valid. You know, they won't check it out. So now we get to the real question that you ask. Is it much different now than then? And yes, it is. It is, because there are more people that are jolted by the crises that we're living through into thinking about the future. It's causing a lot of crusader genes to start to rattle that didn't rattle before. And the number of people that want to hear what we have to say, not that they necessarily believe it, but they want to hear what we have to say, because they know something is wrong,
mm-hmm,
is, I would say it's tenfold greater than it was back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Life was too comfortable in those days. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about, man? It's, look, we got all the money we need. We got freedom. We can travel anywhere in the world. We can say anything we want to say. And it was true. But they didn't realize that the system was being plowed up and seeds were being planted all over the place. And they didn't realize that any of that happened until COVID came along. And the rain came overnight and watered those seeds. And in the morning, when they opened up the window, they looked out and their lawns were filled with mushrooms. All those mayors, all of the governors, all of the health officials, all the news media people around the world, regardless of what country, they were all in unison saying and doing exactly the same things. Those mushrooms came up out of the ground. People said, where did that come from? Now they can see that those seeds were planted there one by one over a long period of time, and that COVID was the signal, the warm sun signal, okay, this is the time to reveal yourself. Mm-hmm. So because any thinking person can understand that things like that don't happen around the world instantly all at the same time, anybody that can see that and thinks about it, they can say, what the heck is going on? Who is behind this? That's what we need to encourage, because once you start asking that question, there's only one answer.
So let me say, Ed, you've spoken for years about this growing and gradual communist takeover here in America. And you're absolutely right. COVID seems to have been the signal. Actually, we can go even a couple of years before that. The election of Donald Trump seemed to have activated many people across the media and in politics. And the idea of a socialist United States of America suddenly became very attractive to a lot of people out there. They looked at Donald Trump and people in, you know, the freedom and liberty movement. They called us fascists. They said that we were the danger to America. We were a danger to democracy itself. And that if only they could stop Donald Trump and get everybody around to their line of thinking, which really was about power and control and censorship. You know, the last several years have really brought a drastic change to America. And I feel that your work has become more relevant than ever. What has that been like to witness this gradual changing in America and then suddenly a much more drastic change overnight?
Well, it's certainly exhilarating, I guess is the best word that I could come up with at the moment. It is exhilarating because prior to COVID, there was nothing really happening except gradual improvement. Well, good, we got this fine young person just woke up and he's going to be on our side. And this person over here, this teacher realizes, oh, I'm going to start instructing my students on some of this stuff. And it was little piecemeal, little stuff like back in the day I was describing earlier when I decided that you can't save the world with speaking before 60 people a night. You're not going to live anywhere long enough for that. And so I realized that the rate at which we were gaining, although we were always gaining, was too slow. And then COVID, of course, changed all that for reasons which we've described. But along with that, COVID not only changed the rate of awakening, which was good, but it signaled the beginning of the mad dash for the finish line. Because I think that our opponents recognized that once they came out fully, like they have done now, and they've exposed themselves, they've taken the velvet glove off of the fist, and you can see the armored fist underneath it. And once they do that, it's going to wake people up. They're not dumb. They always think ahead. They're like the military. They have buildings full of strategists. This is plan A, this is plan B, this is plan C. Now, if this happens, then this will happen, and we have to be prepared for that. So this is plan C4. They've got strategies prepared for no matter what happens. So when we think, oh boy, this I bet this surprises them, forget it. No, they've got a plan for it all along.
Yeah.
And you can be sure that they knew that once they removed the velvet glove from the iron fist, that they knew there'd be a strong public reaction. They knew there'd be people who would demand a man on a white horse to say the right things, who would be a false leader, for example. They knew that. They didn't know it would be a false leader. They said, let's us provide their leader because they're going to demand one. What do? We sit around and wait for them to come up with their own leader? No, we'll provide the leader. So they look for somebody that knows how to do the job, wants the job very badly, has no principles of any kind, will do whatever he can to be important and be a leader. And that's what they do. So we have to be careful about who we get excited over, because just that they give a good speech, what was the rest of their life like? Where did they come from? What's their background? We have to ask those questions. So maybe I wandered into that when I shouldn't have, because it raises too many secondary questions. But once you realize you are in the finish, you are in the final game, and there's a mad dash for the finish line, this is unnerving because it means things are going to happen very, very quickly in the days ahead. Now, you can look at that and say, oh, my goodness, how do I hide? Which you can't. The answer to that is you can't. Or you can look at it the way I try to look at it and do most of the time. And that is that this is great. This is wonderful. We are living in a time where we can make a difference. Mm-hmm. How much better than being, you know, in some middle age period where nothing was happening, no, there was no chance of changing the course of history at all because you're just a peon. You have to get out there with your plow and do what you're told. And somebody comes out and whips you to death. What do you do under those circumstances? So I'm grateful that we're living through this time. We're going to see how it all turns out, and we're going to have a chance to make a difference in the future. Whereas most of the times in history, you don't have that chance. Now, of course, you recognize that there's tremendous price that probably is going to be paid for that, but that's why we're here. There's the old saying that if it happens, it's supposed to happen. I think you have said that, and that's like the desiderata, that the universe is unfolding exactly as it should, because it has to. That's the universe. It's pre-directed. And so if that's the case, why should we be afraid of it? It's what's supposed to happen. And maybe we're supposed to be here for that period, so that we're supposed to do the courageous thing, the bold thing, and make a difference. That's how I look at it. So you could be depressed by it, or you could be exhilarated by it. And I, for one, am quite exhilarated by it.
I'm on the exact same page. You know, I mean, I believe that like we just said, you know, I mean, the world unfolds as exactly as it should. God has a plan. We were placed here at this time in history for a specific reason. And you can either be part of the solution or you can be part of the problem. Certainly, I'm not looking to put my boot on the back of anybody's neck. And I'm looking to help people who might find themselves, under such tyranny. The tools at our disposal have both helped and hindered us. It's quite obvious to me that social media, mass media, television and screens everywhere you look. It's given the whatever you want to call that element that's trying to control us. I often say a global criminal cabal, because it encompasses elements of the United States government, the global government, and the governments of all of these other nations. But they want to enslave us. They want to control us. They want to control the way that we think and the things that we see and the things that we say. And they've done so in many cases using social media. But then at the same time, we have a tremendous opportunity to use those exact same tools to spread our information and our knowledge. You've done a lot over the years, specifically on that front. And I would consider you to be a pioneer of sorts, because, as you said, all of the work that you've done over the years, the films, the books, every project that you've been a part of, it's part of this library of knowledge that people can share and use to wake people up. You've also got a couple of other projects that you've worked on yourself. I mean, obviously, the Red Pill Expo that happens every year. You've got Red Pill University. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the efforts that you and your organization have done to kind of, bring that knowledge to the masses.
Oh, yes, I would be glad to do that, because that's where the action is. That's how, if we're going to serve a constructive, positive purpose, that's how it's, in my view, going to be done, is through something tangible, some kind of a movement, some kind of a coalition of like-minded people globally. And so a long time ago, I began to think, well, how do we create that? I mean, we could sit around and read all the books we want and get very wise and know a lot of history and give great speeches and all that. But how do we translate that into actual reform at the political and social and economic level? Well, the answer is easy. Let's see how our opponents do it. They've never had any problem converting their ideas into political reform. But we've always assumed that because they did it, it's something we should run away from, we should refrain from. But what am I talking about? I'm talking about secret societies, like the one created by Cecil Rhodes. Probably not many of your listeners or my followers and supporters, most of them, never heard about the secret society. In spite of all the books they've read and everything, and they're quite open-minded, and they don't accept everything, but they challenge, and then they say, oh, this makes sense. They'd never heard about the secret society created by Cecil Rhodes, the greatest one of all history, and it's still in effect. It's still running the show. And I don't want to go into that topic now, because we could talk for several hours on that. But when Cecil Rhodes created this organization and then built his Rhodes Scholarship around it to recruit people into it, which is what the Rhodes Scholarship is. That comes as a surprise to people. He decided that, well, we're not going to give our organization a name. It has no name. And that's a strategy that they adopted, pretty smart one. He said, if we have no name, it makes it more difficult for people to talk about us. And in fact, the few authors that have written about it, like Professor Carol Quigley wrote his book on that topic, he doesn't know what to call it. And he's the world's expert on it. And he calls it the organization or the group. You know, that's it. So why do we need to know about that? It's because it's organizations like that that are running the world today. And if we want to overcome that, we have to understand how they work, how they're structured. And so WISOP, Cecil Rhodes admitted in his writings that he had carefully modeled his organization around the structure created by Adam Weishaupt, who is recognized as the creator of the Illuminati, which everybody's heard about. They kind of laugh at it. It's no laughing matter. It was formed quite a while ago, over a couple hundred years ago in Bavaria. And we know a lot about it because their notes and private papers were confiscated by Bavarian police. And they're in their libraries. You can go to your library and get a photographic reproduction of these notes of Adam Weishaupt. And he says that in order for us to conquer the world has to not know that we've conquered it. Okay, that makes a lot of sense, because if people know they're conquered, they're going to fight back. But what if they don't know? Well, they don't know who to fight. So these people think pretty clearly on these things. He said, well, the way to do that is to what we will call rings within rings. And so, for example, when we start an organization, it'll be one visionary with a couple of us, private assistants or personal friends, and they usually have one, two, or three at the core of these giant movements. And then they create a ring around it, and they give it a name. It might be the initiates or something like that, or the great wise ones. Who knows? They give it any name they want. Mm-hmm. They like to give it mysterious names. And that's usually a couple of dozen people. They think they're the whole enchilada. They don't realize that they're dominated by that one, two, or three. Mm-hmm. But it's carefully set up that they are. And then they create another ring around it. Sometimes they call it the round table. And they're the ones that go into different regions and countries. And they may have a couple hundred or a thousand people in it, a couple of thousand people. Even. Then they create other organizations, even bigger, like in the United States, they created the Council on Foreign Relations, which many people have heard about, but they didn't realize it's an outer ring of a secret society created by Cecil Rhodes. And the Council on Foreign Relations has, I think, a little over 4,000 members in it. And it literally runs the United States government and most of the economy of the United States. Those people are in key positions. And the ones working in those corporations and in those universities and so forth don't know that they're part of this ring that's dominated by an inner ring, dominated by yet a smaller ring and so forth. And then finally, they go out to the final ring, which is like political parties, which involve millions and millions of people. And nobody in the political parties at the membership level has any idea that they're dominated by a ringer, an inner ring, and so forth. So we know how they do that. And I remember thinking for the longest time, how can we do that? Because this is what the enemy does. We can't imitate the enemy. And then it dawned on me, well, what's wrong with this strategy? Isn't this the way human nature really works? Yes, it is. These things happen even if you don't have a conspiracy. Take a look at your local community. That's how it naturally forms. There are people that influence other groups, and they influence larger groups, starting at the family level or the banking level or university level or something like that. It's a natural formation. The only difference is that they are secret about it, and they have their objectives are hidden. They lie about it. We could use the same structure or encourage the same structure as long as we're open about it. This is what we do, and this is why we do it, and we have no secrets. Now, there's nothing wrong with it ethically or in any way. So I thought, let's give it a try. Now, all of that is background to your question. You see how I do. I like to go to the foundation. This is what started the whole thing. So how do we emulate that? And so we created an organization called Freedom Force International, mm-hmm. which is like that little group in the center. And it's a small group, but it's people like you and me, and we just devote our lives to these issues. We live and sleep and breathe these issues. And we're scholars. We like to think. We have libraries, huge libraries full of books, and we're ready to go. But we can't save the world. We need lots of people out there, in addition to us, who aren't interested in that kind of involvement in a movement like this. They have lives to live. They have, they have the things to do, families to support. But they're good people, and they know something is wrong, and they want to be part of the solution. So we created a ring around Freedom Force International, and we called it the Red Pill Ring, because that popularizes everything that we want to say. It doesn't cheapen it. It doesn't falsify it in any way. Everything that we have to say at the Freedom Force level can be restated in terms of illusion versus reality, which is the red pill meme. So we can talk about global government at some philosophical level, or we can say, do we really control our government, or are we falling into international hands? And the one is deeper than the other, but they're both the same thing. So the illusion is that the United Nations, for example, is there to bring peace to the world. And the reality is that that's true, but the peace that they're planning to bring is the peace of the cemetery, mm-hmm. where nobody is alive that resists their power. It's peace in both cases, but it's not the peace of living people. It's the peace of dead people. And that's a little extravagant way of saying it, but that's pretty much what's going on.
Maybe hyperbolic, but it's true, though.
It's true, yeah. So we can talk about that at the red pill level a lot easier and reach more people than at the Freedom Force level. So we have the Red Pill University, which is dealing in these issues at that popularized level all the time. And then we have the Red Pill Expo, which is in two events a year, which are sponsored by the Red Pill University. So, and then in the future, just to make it clear, reveal everything, in the future we will have another ring, which is, we'll call it the Born Free Ring. It'll be a caucus at first, a caucus within the Republican Party and a caucus within the Democrat Party. And we'll gather all the good people we can within those parties into a Born Free caucus. And of course, it's based on that popular song, you know, Born Free, Free as the Wind Blows, da 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 da, da, and so forth. It's got some oomph to it, and it's real. It's not phony. It's a good slogan because it's real. And then if and when that fails to change the party structure of the Republican group or the Democrat group, then we take our caucus and we leave and we form a new party. And that one will be the one that will be the biggest ring around us. So there's our strategy. And now the question is, well, what's this Red Pill Expo all about? Now you see where it fits in this total thing. We're trying to reach out to millions and millions of people who would never be interested in reading all these books that we're talking about. But they know in their heart and their mind, their instinct, that we have a big problem. And it's wrapped up with our liberty and our privacy and our humanity. That's all they need. That's far enough. That's beautiful. Their movements can be built on that, and they're solid movements. They can't be twisted as long as we keep focused on those principles. That's what it's all about.
But I really like that because, at the end of the day, these are nonpartisan issues. I mean, the idea of liberty, the idea of freedom, I mean, it's something that we're supposed to be afforded by very nature of the fact that we're alive. And, they're enshrined in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. But they have been politicized and polarized to such a degree by those secret societies that are running the levers of power behind the scenes. And in certain cases, they've become almost dirty words. You know, the idea that you would be interested in liberty is now somehow an extreme point of view from the mouthpiece of the mainstream media or from certain elements of the Democrat Party. And so I think we need to be able to come together on these things and realize that if we're going to survive as a society, as a nation, we have to rally around them and understand even what they mean. You know, I mean, people are so brainwashed today. The useful idiots of the left and even plenty of them on the right. People are just spouting those slogans. They're spouting the talking points that they're being given by the people that that they're following and by the political leaders. And then as that's happening, our rights and our liberties are being chipped away and we're being pitted against each other. And I see it not as a battle of ideologies necessarily between the left and the right. I mean, this is really about, you know, the elites and the plebs. You know, those people that are running the scene, are running the machine behind the scenes, and then us, the regular people who are just trying to make our lives every single day. I mean, we want to survive. We want to be able to walk in, down the street and say what we think and feel, you know, no fear of retribution for doing so. So, yeah, I really like the approach and the way that you described it. I had never thought about it. But, you know, the those secret rings that are running the world, this is something that I'm highly interested in. I think a lot of people wonder about because there are so many secret societies. You know, you think about the Illuminati or the United Nations. We've got the, you know, OTO or, you know, any number of Club of Rome, you know, it goes on, Committee of 300. All of these secret societies and groups are running different aspects of it. But at the end of the day, who do you really see as the man behind the curtain? You had mentioned Cecil Rhodes. Do you think that it all roads lead to Rhodes, or is there somebody else behind it that we can point to?
Good question. I'll start by saying I don't know, because I really don't. And I hate to anybody think that, oh, Griffin thinks this, Griffin thinks that, therefore it must be true. No, I don't know, because unfortunately they don't invite me to their meetings.
Sure.
I guess I don't know their handshake or something. But you can figure out the important things. Let me dig a little deeper again, as usual, go down to the foundation. You mentioned before that you didn't think it was a question of right versus left. And you are absolutely correct on that, because when you analyze what is the difference between the right and the left, and there is no difference. When you think about definitions, for example, what's the difference between communism and Nazism? The flag, mm-hmm. but the principles, the principle, the language of the Germans versus the Russians or something. But no, they cross country lines too. I discovered that years ago when I was reading some of these old books, and I discovered all these words: socialism, communism, fascism, Nazism, New Dealism, liberalism, right versus left, Republicans versus Democrats, blah, 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 blah. It's part of that division process that you mentioned, where they try and force us to choose sides, when in fact both sides are controlled by them, mm-hmm. because they know that we demand conflict. We must feel that we've had a battle, that we tried to win, but we just failed because we were beaten. Now, that's why they always put up opposition of their own, so that people, the general public, can be sucked into that feeling that, well, we tried, you know, I'm a Republican, but darn it, we lost. Why? Because of what we call them rhinos now. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, Republicans in name. No, they're not Republicans in name only. They're false leaders that went in there with that as their mission. Don't think that they're good people. They know what they're doing. They're false leaders. We have to choose between them and the left, and that's what's the difference. They're both collectivists. That's the point. The real words that we should be using is collectivism versus individualism. And if we stick to those words, there will be very little chance for confusion as to which side a person is on, if you understand what those words mean. And that's another topic where we spend a lot of time, even in our Red Pill projects, discussing and analyzing the difference between individualism and collectivism, because that is the essence of our world conflict today. So who is behind this? Okay, we'll come back to your question. Well, let's follow the breadcrumbs. They're collectivists. Every one of them is a collectivist, because that's the tool by which they administer their tyranny on the people, because the people have to accept it. They believe, oh, it's in our own self-interest. It's for the greater good of the greater number. That's the mantra of collectivism. So if people actually believe that, and indeed they do, and indeed I did at one time, well, then how can I complain? It's for the greater good of the greater number. And that's it. That's democracy. We don't realize that this is a terrible thought, because it's always spoken of as the ideal, but it's not. I mean, in a lynch mob, there's only one dissenting vote.
Right.
He's at the end. He's so at the true. End of the rope. So if you believe in majority rule democracy, well, lynch mobs are just fine. You got to think deeper than that.
Yeah.
you got to go deeper than that. Even are there things that even the majority cannot do? How about the majority of everybody but one? If you have the whole world against one person, mm-hmm. is that one person still entitled to a human right, a free speech, or peaceful assembly? Who can't assemble with himself, but any of the other rights? Is he lost his human rights simply because everybody else has gone crazy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are the issues. So once you realize that the real issue is collectivism versus individualism, the center of the power of society, then these things clear up. So now, having said something about collectivism, who are the collectivists that are running the show? Well, this is where it gets a little tricky. Some of them are very visible. And it's easy. You know, the old saying is follow the money. Who's got the money? And you had the answer to your question.
Yeah.
Who's got the money? Well, in the United States, that would be the Rockefeller Syndicate. It's not just the Rockefellers, but there's a cluster. Right? All the big banks are associated with that. In the rest of the world, it would be the Rothschilds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they try and remain in the background, always have. You don't hear much about them in the newspaper. You think all they do is just raise prize horses and grapes or something, fine wines. I think they're just social butterflies. No, no, and no. They're very, very powerful people. It's their people that control the price, the exchange price of gold and silver every day. They're deeply involved in the economic mesh of the world. And there are people like that in other countries, but we start with that list. And then there's this other thing, which is not even so visible as that. And I don't know how to analyze it. And that is, there's an occult element to this.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether it's the same people that are in that monetary level that are also at the occult level, or whether it's two different levels, one on top of the other. I really don't know. To our purposes, it makes no difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, and we know it's real, and we can't ignore it. What we do about it, of course, is another thing. You can't just say, well, all people who wear their hair in a certain way are occultists, and therefore we should eliminate them. That's not our principle at all. We have to take away their tools of tyranny. And the tools of tyranny have a name, and it's called collectivism. So I always go back to that level of analysis and say, if we want to solve any of these problems that I've been talking about, we have to take away the tools of collectivism. That means we've got to re-educate the world. Right now, 9 out of 10 people or 99 out of 100 people would absolutely endorse almost every principle of collectivism, because they don't understand. There is no solution to this problem until we get at least the tipping point of 15% of the population to understand the difference between collectivism and individualism, and then to devote their lives in the defense of collectivism. I mean, I said that wrong.
Individualism.
Yeah, good thing I caught that. Now, in the defense
of individualism. Somebody's going to clip that.
Yeah. I'm going to clip it, yeah. You watch and see. See, Griffin is a phony. I told you that.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's
great.
Well, I want you to clip it, man.
Okay.
We'll have a good time with it. All right, you guys, the phone lines are open. So if you have any questions for G. Edward Griffin, by all means, jump in there. I've dropped the Zoom link into the relevant chats all over. And I've also put the information up on the screen. Let me jump over here to the foxhole and we'll.
A human catastrophe is closing in. Nobody knows how far this one is going to go. You can feel the heat as tension is rising globally. War is expensive. Open a Noble Gold Investments IRA today, and you can claim a free 3-ounce silver American Virtue coin. Just use the promo code GOLD. Go to NobleGoldInvestments.com now.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
See if there's any specific questions that the audience has had thus far. Porpoiseful, thank you very much for that donation. PC Tech Pro says, thank you, Edward Griffin, for your vision. Let the arrests... Oh, actually, I have to hit pause so that doesn't jump around on me. Let the arrests begin. Thank you for the shades. Donna Bo Libby, thank you for the cookie. A Boneless Chicken says, best info on Foxhole. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you saying that. Sean Joe, thank you for the cookie. Tamar Growl, thank you for the can. Sean Joe, thank you for the cookie. 123SKG, appreciate that. Nakaz 808 says, awesome interview, the original Morpheus. Yes, sir, that's the truth. Alicia B111, thank you for that cookie. Ponlo Picasso, thank you for the can. Matt 1776 bought a diamond tier subscription. Oh, hey, guess what, guys? You can now buy subscriptions for your favorite streamers over there on the Foxhole. I really appreciate that. It's just like when we had subscriptions on DLive and then, you know, even further back on YouTube. When you purchase the subscription, it will automatically support your favorite streamer every single month. And of course, a portion of that also benefits the platform. And the Foxhole is, very close to my heart because these are my friends. They created our own streaming platform so that we don't have to worry about being shut down or having our speech silenced. So thank you very much, Matt. Slugtrail says, I hear you need a hammer now to be in secret societies. That's a Paul Pelosi joke right there. Oh, good Lord. And then also Ponlo Picasso says, marked safe from a hammer fight in my underwear. Good God. One of the interesting aspects of, the communication system that we have in place now and the speed with which information flows, it's almost very difficult for them to be able to control the narrative in the same way they could in the past. You know, if we go back even 20 years, Ed, and Paul Pelosi gets caught with a naked gay activist in his living room having a fight with a hammer. I think the police and San Francisco, they would have been able to cover that up, and maybe we never would have known about it. But almost immediately, the 911 call is released. The police are talking about it. We've got images from helicopters, and and everybody knows. You know, I mean, I think there's been rumors about Paul Pelosi for a long time, and his lifestyle choices are really none of my business. But it's important and it's relevant. In terms of the story they tried to spin around it, they wanted to make this guy, David DePape, appear to be some type of right wing extremist when I think it's everything is points to the contrary. And you really can't get past it. I'm wondering about the opportunities that we see here. You know, this is, in my opinion, an opportunity to educate people and get them to think about things in a different way. Do you think that the unraveling that we're seeing right now is indicative of our chances to, take back our country in the near future?
Well, excuse me for taking a moment on all these questions, but
okay.
I think if so many issues come up with these simple questions. This is not in my mind, let me phrase it with that. In my mind, I'm as patriotic as anybody else, but this is not an issue about taking back our country. This is an issue about restoring humanity.
Mm-hmm.
It's bigger than even our own country. Now, I agree we have to start somewhere. We start in our own families. Then we go to our communities and so forth. We work up to our nation. Then we can worry about the rest of the world. I agree with that totally. Start with where we can have an influence and build. But this is not just a question of America, because we're not going to do it in America alone. It's got to happen globally, or it won't happen at all. Mm-hmm. That's my view of it, because it is a global battle right now. And so how do we, and it's not a question of take back either. It's a question of how do we build upon our experience, because we don't want to just take it back. That's if we got to where we were politically and reverse all of the legislation, every bit of it, rewind the clock back to, say, 30 years ago or something like that, that's still not where we want to be. Mm-mm. It's better than where we are today. But there'll be some problems that would show up in there, too, that we wouldn't want to get rid of. So it's not just to go back to the status quo at some previous time in history. I think the answer is that let's take this opportunity and think about what went wrong, and let's rebuild, not from a starting point in the past, but let's move forward to something that's better, that we could build back better, if I want to borrow a phrase.
I've gotten caught in that one before, too.
Yeah, it's not a bad, I mean, it's a slogan, isn't it? It sounds good, but it also is good in this case.
Yeah,
we need to build back. And there's a better way than even what it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember that our Constitution, it was a wonderful document. I think it was the most advanced political document in history at the time it was written.
Mm-hmm.
And but it wasn't perfect. We know that. And we can't just say, all we have to do is just get back to the Constitution. Well, that would be a good start, but that's not all we have to do, because if that's all we did, we would go through the same cycle again,
mm-hmm.
where the Constitution would be subverted. We've got to figure out, how did they subvert the Constitution, and how do we prevent that from happening the next time, even if we did restore it? Well, they subverted the Constitution because there were some loopholes in it. There were, you know, like the general welfare clause.
Mm-hmm.
That was a terrible loophole. I mean, everything they want to do that we don't like, they say, well, this is for the general welfare. That's right out of the collectivist playbook. This is for the greater good of the greater number. That alone was a huge hole in the hull of the ship. So we've learned since then that those are the kinds of loopholes that were put into the system. And issues like slavery were not addressed directly, and they should have been. But you can't blame the writers of the Constitution for that completely, because they were building a union, and we're not going to get agreement of all of the 13 states on these points. If they had not compromised, there would have been no union, and we would have been much worse off than we are today. There have been 13 little tyrannies probably fighting against each other and all that sort of thing. So I look at it this way, that the U.S. Constitution was a brilliant, magnificent beta model. Now we've had a chance to see how that worked out. Let's go back and patch up the holes and build a better Constitution, with all retaining all of the excellent principles that it had, and a few more. I don't think it needs many more. In fact, if I ever finish the book I'm working on, that will be the final chapter in the book, is a Constitution for the World. What are those few additional clauses that need to be added to a constitution,
mm-hmm.
and maybe one or two that need to be removed, that would make it more ideal and more sturdy against the forces of subversion from within? So I don't think that answers your question. I wish I had a simpler answer, just like vote Republican or something like that.
Well, you know, in a manner of speaking, I mean, we have to start somewhere. That's the thing. You know, I mean, we are dealing with very complicated issues. I mean, we're talking about generations of bad decisions, and you know, maybe not bad for us, calculated for them, that have gotten us to this moment in history. And if we're going to unravel what's taken place and create a more perfect union, get back to the foundations of what America was supposed to be. You know, it's going to take time. And you're absolutely right. This is not just about America. For me, you know, that's where I'm at. I'm in Florida. I care about my nation. As so goes America, so goes the world. So we've got to take care of ourselves before we can export anything good to the rest of the world. It's a difficult issue. And hopefully people are working on it. But we've got the midterms on Tuesday. Certainly, I think that there is a tremendous opportunity with political candidates that are running right now that maybe otherwise wouldn't have run if things hadn't gotten so off the rails and if the powers that be hadn't worked to subvert what little liberty we have left. So I think that it takes people of all types. And really, the candidates that we have in this particular election cycle are better than we've had in a long time. It's going to take a changing of the guard all across the board. And we have to start at this point and then move forward from here. We've got
Zach, I have a question for you. Sure. on that.
Yeah,
I agree with everything you're saying on the assumption that the votes will be counted.
Well, you know, absolutely. I mean, that's certainly paramount among my fears. I would like to get your thoughts on this. You know, I see this midterm election as slightly different from the presidential election. Yes, there will undoubtedly be efforts to cheat and to subvert the vote of the people. But in this instance, we are talking about many different races across many different states. In 2020, they needed to steal it in five or six areas. And it was obvious that they did that through the injection of universal mail-in ballots and absentee votes and controlling of the military overseas ballots. All of these opportunities for them to get paper ballots and forge them or through the use of the voter rolls and services like Eric, the institution of the Center for Tech and Civic Life, Mark Zuckerberg, all of the money that they injected. And then, of course, the specter of COVID. You know, it was like a perfect storm of ways for them to manage the vote and ensure that in those five or six states, they were able to inject enough ballots to steal the presidential election. I think certainly there were probably a couple of other elections that were manipulated as well. But now we're talking about not just one really important election, but many, many important elections all over the nation. And the COVID element is not there. Something like 20 states have challenged the illegal COVID regulations that they put in place in order to steal it in 2020. And I think a lot more people are paying attention, Ed. I think, you know, specifically the RNC has trained something like 70,000 plus poll watchers. That says nothing about the number of independent poll watchers that have also decided they're going to be involved this time around. And nobody's going to be told that they have to get out of the count rooms. You know, for all its faults, the RNC this time around is planning on having lawyers and legal challenges ready, whereas they didn't in 2020. That was huge in terms of why things went the way they did. For me, I see all of these things and I think, hey, you know, it's better than 2020. So we have to see what happens. But I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that everything you said is something we need.
Yeah.
My thoughts also include the fact that our opponent is not just sitting on his hands.
Right.
He could see everything coming that you're describing. And so my question is, what did the opponent do to anticipate this and to counter it? I'm sure he has plans. And I don't know whether it's just to replace, they pick up the ballots at the pickup stations and swap them on the way, or what? Are the poll watchers going to have to become truck watchers as well? Things like that. I've heard nobody talk about that kind of thing. And it makes me nervous. That's all. My thought is I'm very nervous on that because it seems like people talked about the stealing of the election in 2020, but nobody has done anything really substantial about it. And except that, I guess the poll watcher thing is very encouraging, but I don't know what the details of that are. It could be just a token, could be an appearance and not really very effective, which if I were on the other side, that's what I would do. I would allow something to appear effective, which in fact I know that it can be easily overcome. Appearances are more important than actuality in this case.
Yeah.
So I, again, here's my skepticism coming to the front. I don't know. And if we can't solve the election fraud problem, then we're in really deep bandini.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's it. I suppose I look at it with cautious optimism. You know, and this kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier. You know, I mean, you can you can bemoan the terrible position you're in, or you can get out there and fight like, you know, your last of dying breath depends upon it, because it really does. You know, I mean, we're standing on the brink at this point. You know, things are either going to go one way or they're going to go the other. I certainly hope that we are victorious. But, you know, regardless of whether or not we are, I think that, you know, this is just one. This is just one more battle. You know, I mean, like, this is a continuum of events that we're going to see play out. And what happens on Tuesday, I think, will give us an indication of what direction we're moving in. I pray that it's going to be in the right direction.
And you're doing your part. I mean, assuming that the mechanism is in place, we still have to have the votes.
Yes.
Have to have the voters. Yep. So you can't ignore any part of this chain. It'll be the weakest link that gives. But I'm glad to see that you are not pessimistic about that, because that's encouraging.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, we're going to bring in our first caller, and it's actually a really good friend of the program, a co-host that I work with on another program called Altered State. Look at that. My friend Brad Goetz. Brad, thank you so much for calling and being the first caller. How you doing tonight?
I am doing great, and thank you for having me on. And Mr. Griffin, I would just like to say it's an honor to talk to the legend.
The legend. That's funny. Well, thank you, Rod. Nice to see you.
I guess if I had one question, first, I would like to say your breakdown on fractional reserve banking is one of the big moments where it blew my mind and I started to actually get it, the whole system. But one thing I did want to ask you about was kind of pertaining to what we watched in 2020 with the riots. There's a lot of people on the other side who also think they're fighting the establishment, although they keep fighting us for some reason. I don't understand how that's going to work. But to them, they think burning things down and wrecking everything is the way to go about it. And I saw a great breakdown one time where you were talking about revolts and how they pretty much are always doomed to fail. And I don't know if you'd ever want to give a little clarity on that for the audience, because I thought it was such a great breakdown on why a violent revolt versus actually trying to do what we've been trying to do, what you've been trying to do for a lifetime. It's just what we're doing is so much more effective.
Well, yeah, that's a great topic. And I love these topics because it allows me to talk about strategies and principles rather than just issues. You know, should we do this? Should we do that? But it's how we do these things that relate to the questions that you just asked. Well, yeah, first comes to understand the necessity of understanding the difference between a revolution and a revolt. And if you look it up in the dictionary, there's some differences of view, but generally they all agree that a revolution is an organized opposition to an existing government to replace it. But the word is organized. It's made up of people and institutions that are already holders of power within that system. It might be the revolt of a royalty class or some political party or some section within the existing system that now wants to strike for power. Might be the military, for example, like a coup d'etat. Anyway, those things would all come under the heading of revolutions, because they're backed not only by a lot of people, but they're backed by people who hold power in the system, like the United States Revolution. Those were not just farmers out there fighting. They were all members of a militia, and the leaders were all members of their local legislative bodies. They were elected to position. There were courts in existence. There were rules and regulations. There was ammunition stored and cannons and stored in warehouses and communications and the practices. And these were governments. These were not just the people there. They got fed up and went out screaming out the door. So revolutions are not guaranteed of success, but they contain the potential for success because they have the potential for matching the power of the existing system. Whereas a revolt is just where, like, the guy sticks his head out the window and he says, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." And he gets a lot of his buddies out in the street and they're going around banging pots and pans, and some of them carry guns and some of them don't. And they don't know who their leader is. All they know is they're not going to take it anymore. And they're easy to overcome. And in the modern world, totalitarian systems encourage that. The first time I became aware of that was in the Hungarian Revolution. Some author called it the Ersatz Revolt, or Ersatz Revolution. I think it was revolt. Ersatz in their language meant phony. It was fake. Mm. And they pretended to have a revolt. And the idea was to get everybody out in the open that could identify who their future opponents would be.
Yes.
And so they wanted to create the illusion of potential success. Ah, and they come out and, yeah, we've always been against the system, and now we're going to overthrow it. And of course, it was a revolt. There was no organization, no funding, no leadership, no plans, no strategy, no idea of who's going to run the show after they win. None of that. So revolts always lose. And we have to keep that in mind when people on our side are talking about, we're going to have a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not talking about a revolution. They're talking about revolts. So that might be what you're thinking about. Is that the theme that you were talking about?
Joe, you're muted, Brad.
That was it?
Oh, I would say 100% yes, and I could not agree more, man. Uh-huh. I think that's such an important distinction to make.
It's so important, because all the time somebody is inevitably going to pop up in the chat and say, you know, when is this going to be enough? We need to be out in the streets. And I, you know, and it's just it's right. Without some type of organization or leadership structure, it's just going to be a revolt that gets crushed so easily. And those people that might otherwise be useful in some other way are just going to get removed from the equation.
Oh, yeah. They'll be quickly removed. And that's, as I said before, often that's the reason the existing system not only allows a revolt, but actually encourages it. Because
mm-hmm.
they want to find out who the people are secretly waiting to reveal themselves as opponents. They want to know now. And they'll butcher them all. They'll kill them all.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. And yes, I know what you mean. I've actually heard you also break down the pressure from below and the pressure from above to kind of squeeze them out, and, you know, why they would support people doing such things who think they're helping, but they're really supported by the very people who are trying to crush them. And just thank you so much for everything you've done. And thank you, Zach, for letting me come on.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. I'll talk to you soon. Okay. You know, I had mentioned earlier in the broadcast, or maybe it was when we spoke privately, that, you know, the work you've done, it seems pretty much prophetic at this point. I mean, going back to the interview with Yuri Bezmenov, you know, what he described in that interview is, I mean, very, very close to what we've seen play out here in America. It's quite obvious that the tools that he was talking about have been directly used against us, and in an exacting manner. I mean, to a T. when you, as you've watched this play out over the years, has there been any element of this global criminal cabal that has been attempting to subvert America and humanity that has surprised you, or have you seen it and watched it play out and thought, you know, hey, you know, this is exactly what I thought was going to happen?
Nothing has surprised me in terms of strategy. Mm-hmm. Because it's playbook stuff. It's works. It works every time. So why would they change it? But what did surprise me is their choice of issues. Oh, I guess issues is as good. In other words, the COVID thing surprised me. And I'm embarrassed by that because it shouldn't have. Everything I needed to see was visible back when HIV was the big scare. Mm-hmm. It was all there. It was a rehearsal, you might say. Even the same people were running the show,
right?
Like Fauci and so forth. But I didn't see it. I hadn't really focused on the use of a pandemic as the scare issue. You know, anybody that's read my book on the Federal Reserve will recall that there's a chapter or section of a chapter in there on a book on the report from Iron Mountain. Mm-hmm. And it was a think tank study. That's how it was presented anyway, on how to control the population and make them content with their tyranny. The idea, they worded it this way, as I recall, they said, the purpose of this study is to how to stabilize governments. Okay, well, that sounds pretty good. Well, we want a stable government, don't we?
Of course.
But you read further and read between the lines, and suddenly you realize when they call it a stable government, they mean one that cannot be overthrown by an unhappy population.
Mm-hmm.
No revolutions, thank you. And so the real purpose of the study was how to keep the people content with their state, their content with their tyrant. And the answer in general was, well, we scare them to death with things like wars. We always have to have a war. Well, Machiavelli told us that years and years ago, mm-hmm. that best way to keep the prince in power is to keep the people content because they're afraid of being conquered by a foreign enemy. So you've got to have wars and rumors of wars going on all the time in order to keep the people content. So it was the same strategy, but it modernized. And so the purpose of the book was to analyze all the different things that could be used to replace war as the fear force so that people will be content with, because they fear the opposite war more than they fear their tyranny. And in a very scholarly manner, they analyzed all the things that could possibly be used to scare people. And they even talked about the possibility of a phony alien invasion.
Yes.
That would scare the daylights out of people. They'd rally behind their government, no matter how tyrannical it is, if they thought it was the only way they could protect themselves from aliens. And they said, well, we're not ready for that yet. We don't have the technology to make that convincing. So they were looking for issues. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because they did mention environmental pollution and so forth. They said, mm-hmm. that's a possibility. If we could create the illusion that the world is going to hell through environmental degradation, they said there's enough evidence of that. There's a lot of pollution out there, but they said this is not pollution we're talking about. We're talking about the end of civilization. Mm-hmm. And we could possibly crank that up. And if we promote it hard enough, maybe people would fear that more than they fear war. But they said, we don't think so. We think war is still the only way to do it. Now, the reason I mention that is because at that time, I'm really studying this thing and I'm thinking they made a correct decision. But now I'm looking back at it and say, why didn't they talk about pandemics?
Mm-hmm.
If they had written about pandemics, they would have said, well, that's even better than war, because the enemy is something you can't even see. It's a virus or a bug or some kind. You can't even see it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everywhere, you know, they'll need our protection against it. So but they didn't see it in that book and I didn't see it. So the answer to your question is the use of a pandemic did surprise me. But once I saw it, I realized, oh, my gosh, it's such an obvious choice.
Well, it's brilliant at the end of the day, brilliant. You know, and here's the thing. maybe they did consider it. Well, I mean, it, certainly, you know, you can go back to Event 201. They were definitely preparing for it. Maybe they did consider it, but they just weren't broadcasting it in the way they had broadcasted things previously. But yes, absolutely. I think that's a great answer, and I'm right on board with you. Okay, let's bring in our next caller. And caller, you're on the air. Can we get a name?
Yes. Hi, this is Sue.
Hi, Sue. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Zach. Thank you for having me on. Excellent show.
Thank
really
you.
A great conversation.
Appreciate yes. it. What's
Mr.
your question
Griffin.
For Mr. Griffin?
Yes. Okay. I first want to thank you for all the work you've done. You're just such a legend. I've followed you on issues from the environment and tyranny and the dangers of cellular technology. And my question is, just, you know, with your amazing wisdom, what do you think the next step is for humanity? What do we do next as far as building back a new world?
Well, your question is, what do we do? I guess that means, what should we do? I don't know what we're going to do. That depends on the reaction of people who are listening to this program and others like it all around the world, because we don't have enough soldiers. We don't have enough boots on the ground right now to do anything much except talk about it and complain and try and get organized. But when the window finally closes and it's a push comes to shove thing, and if we had enough people in important positions, we simply get rid of collectivists. We make individualism something that everybody talks about and understands, and we begin to reshape our state legislatures and our constitutions in such a way that collectivism is diminished further and diminished further. It has to be phased out. You can't just chop it down like a tree, because it would fall on you and destroy everything. But anyway, I think the quick answer to your question is, what do we do if we have the power to do it, is to rewrite all the constitutions in the world to make them constitutional republics, which means that they will be advocating the principles of individualism, not collectivism. And that's going to take time. So mm-hmm. the hidden part of your question is, will we see it in our lifetime, if that's what we all want? Now, the bad part is, no, I don't think we're going to see it in our lifetime. But we can lay the foundation for it. And it's quite a pleasant thought. When I go to sleep at night, I can often go to bed with a smile on my face, thinking, I just laid another big brick in the foundation today. It's a little higher than it was yesterday. And future generations somewhere down the line is going to discover this brick. And they're going to live in the vision that we are creating.
That's wonderful. I tell my kids all the time, because I'm always sharing negative things with them, and I'm try to brighten that up a little bit by telling them that this is our opportunity to make the world what we want it to be, you know, to make it better than it's been in the past, because we'll never go back to what we had.
No.
You know, and if you were to change the Constitution, what would you remove from our current Constitution?
Great question.
Well, I was talking briefly about that earlier. I would certainly mm-hmm. remove the General Welfare Clause. And
okay.
It's not so much that I would remove anything, is what would I add to it? And I think what I would add to it would be something that would make very clear what is the function of the state that is tolerated and what is not. And you'll find those principles in what we call the Creed of Freedom. And, for example, I'll just give you one. The collectivism is based on the assumption that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. That's what I was taught in school, and I bought into it totally. I thought, it sounds good. Greater good of the greater number. That's what democracy is all about. Little did I know at the time that we didn't live in a democracy, and it's a good thing we didn't, although we do now, unfortunately, because mm-hmm. democracy is the unbridled will of the majority. A republic, the majority is limited on what it can do if it violates the rights of one individual. Each one single individual can be protected by the state if the Constitution says so. So one individual standing against millions of people are still entitled to his right to free trial, his right to freedom of speech. You know, things that we, whatever is on that list of human rights, one person has it against the greed and the passion of the majority. Otherwise, some demagogue can come along and whip up the mob, and there goes your liberty. So things like that, a couple of points like that need to be added to the Constitution. And one thing I would do, I'm glad you asked that question, because I'm kind of working on that problem right now as the last chapter in a book I've been struggling with for quite a while. And it's called A Constitution for the World. And
Oh, great.
Yeah. And one of the things I think I want to do is write the Constitution into two columns. There's a notation, annotation column on the left, and of course the text column on the right. I think if our founding fathers, when they wrote our Constitution, had done that. So on the right side, they say, you know, we have these different branches of government, you know, legislative, judicial, and executive, blah, blah, blah. And on the left side, they said, we're doing this because we don't trust people in government. We're doing this because governments are magnets to the criminal class. We're doing this to protect the state from being subverted from liars and cheats and thieves. You know, something like that, maybe not quite so bluntly, but tell them why these provisions are put there in the first place. Then, as a kid growing up, when people are asking them to study the Constitution, they're not only getting a lot of words about principles of like how many people does it take to vote in this and that and what the limitations are, but they learn the why behind it as well. So I think if I had a couple of more provisions of the nature of which I'm discussing written in a more dignified manner, I hope, and then have an annotation column as to why they're in there, we might have one heck of a constitution for the world.
Brilliant. I love it. I can't wait to read your book.
I can't wait to finish it.
All right, Sue, thank you so much for your call.
I get it. Thank you very much.
All right.
Enjoy your evening.
Have a great night.
Bye.
All right, so we've got a couple of thank yous. I'll go through those at the end, but my friend Patriot Politics Research is on the line, bringing him into the conversation. And then also someone over on Getter, we'll get into this after the calls, but wants us to discuss Manning Johnson a bit. Former Communist Party leader here in the United States who exposed the communist plan to incite racial division here in America. And looks like it's come to pass. Welcome to the show, Mele. Good to see you, buddy. Just waiting for your audio to connect. Don't have can you see us? Can you see that we're here on the call? Hold on. Let me send him a text message. No audio. You're live. Sometimes when people are on Zoom on their phone, they can't tell that I've let them into the call. Let me try this. Okay. Well, that's not working. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Manning Johnson. Manning Johnson, I'm assuming you're familiar with him.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. What can you tell us about him and what he said in his book years ago?
Well, Manning Johnson came to my attention when I was doing research on the civil rights movement way back in the 60s and 70s. And, it turns out that Manning Johnson was a black fellow, and he was recruited into the Communist Party, USA. He was sent to Moscow and trained there, and trained as a real genuine communist revolutionary, how to subvert the American government and the American system. And they trained him and sent him back to the United States and put him to work as an organizer. And he did that for a little while. And then finally, he figured it out. He left the party and wrote a book called Color, Communism, and Common Sense. And in that book, he said, I was a devout communist. I was dedicated to the cause. I was trained. I was ready to go to bring down America until I found out that the comrades didn't give a damn about the black people. It was all just propaganda to use the black population in America like cannon fodder is his choice of words, to bring down the existing system so that they could build their tyrannical empire upon the rubble of what we destroyed. He said, when I discovered that my purpose was simply to destroy what we have, and then they would get rid of me and everybody else, because once we figured it out, we would be very unhappy. He said, I decided it was time for me to leave. So he left, and he wrote this book in which he tells all. And it was a very powerful book. By the way, that book I just discovered is easily downloaded from the internet. It's just search for Manning Johnson, Color Communism, Common Sense, and type in the word download. And there are several sources on the internet that have put his book up in digital form.
Yes.
It's worth reading.
It's quite interesting, especially in light of what we've seen in the last couple of years with the emergence of BLM, Black Lives Matter. I mean, the founders of that organization are, admitted socialists, and they appear to be, putting that plan into action here in modern day. But, at that time, it was the Russians that were the proponents of communism. You know, now it's the Chinese that are the real ones pushing communism. I've always wondered, is what we're seeing playing out here, is that an element of the current Russian government as well, or is it more likely a larger global organization, one of those secret societies that we mentioned earlier? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. I think the strategies that we're seeing unfold are not really Soviet in nature. They're Leninist in nature.
Okay.
They come from the writings of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who wrote about how to come to power. Massive writings on that topic alone. And what we're seeing now mostly was the brain product of Lenin. And because he said, now that we got the Communist Party, he said, we're not Marxists anymore. Now we're communists. We're more militant. And we are now going to have a Communist Party. And now we become more like a military organization. And we're not concerned with ideology, how to convince people that socialism or collectivism is a good thing. Our goal is how to come to power. How do we destroy the existing system? Mm-hmm. How do we overcome our opponent? How do we come to power? So all of these strategies are basically Leninist in nature, and it's got nothing to do with, really nothing to do with communism.
Okay.
It's just how do you come to power? And so that's my short answer to it. And the strategies don't change because they work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They will never change. They might be bent a little bit to incorporate some new twist of the modern society, like cryptocurrencies or something. I don't know how that would change anything, but it might. But the basic strategies are, let me summarize what the basic strategy is.
Okay.
It's number one, lie. Tell people that you are an anti-communist. That's number one. Don't let them know that you are promoting communism, preferably. Well, in many cases, they have two branches. They have openly communist, and then the other branch, which is communist, but pretends to be anti-communist, and they fight each other, so they can control both groups. The communists and the anti-communists are both the same, but they fight each other, and so then you and I have to choose between which one.
Right.
Because if we don't like communism, then what do we like? Well, the other one. If we're not on the left, then we must be on the right.
Right.
So let's get on the right side. Say, well, now we're rightists. Now we're fascists and Nazis and so on. So that's part of Leninism. And so they lie. And then the other part is how they bring down the existing system. They're not trying to solve problems like improve wages or rights or anything. They talk about those things, but their goals are always how to destroy it. The destruction is the goal of all of these street operations. And once you understand that, you quit saying, gee, these people are making mistakes. You know, they're losing a lot of popularity when they do this. Yeah, they know that, of course,
yeah.
Because they got their people on the other side pretending to be opposite to them, who are talking about, here's how we solve this problem. We defund the police, or we do, or we have, get a new person promoted by George Soros in as the assistant district attorney general, and or the district attorney. So there's always, they create the problem that scares people, all the firebombing and the violence and the vulgarity and the destruction in the street. And then they have the solution with their other group. This is the pressure from above and from below that somebody mentioned.
Yep.
Create the pressure from below to destroy and scare. Then their people at the top pretend as though, oh, they're just as concerned as we are. And we have the solution. We'll send money to them. That'll calm them down. That's how it works.
It's
and the
true.
Gum-chewing public goes for it every time.
Yep, absolutely. All right, so we've got Mele on with audio now. Good to see you, buddy. How you doing tonight?
Pretty good. How you doing, Zach?
Excellent, excellent. So what's your question for Mr. Griffin?
Oh, this is so cool. And I saw him live on your channel. I was like, I have to call in. Mr. Griffin, thanks for being a pioneer for all the years and being a guiding light for truth and research for all of us newbies. I've been trying to see whether the business plot that was exposed by General Smedley Butler in 1934 for the attempted coup on President FDR, that was thwarted by him coming out and exposing, and then there was Congress saying that there was evidence to suggest that there was a fascist plot to overthrow President FDR. And that just, there was no accountability for that. And then I can't help it but connect it to the current situation with us funding literal Nazis, the old Nazis that the CIA protected post-World War II under the auspices of Cold War intelligence. Were the Nazis ever really defeated? Because it sure seems like, you know, even after President Trump declassified some JFK documents in 2018 that suggested that the FBI and CIA knew that Adolf Hitler was living in Argentina. I mean, if it never was really fully held accountable during Nuremberg, it just sure seems like that's evidence what's going on now, especially with our government and the world funding the Azov Nazis that were the ones that were protected by the CIA. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
This is something near and dear to my heart, and I've often speculated that the Germans actually won World War II because that Nazi brain trust was just transferred from Germany over here to America in Project Paperclip, and then all of their other contemporaries went over to the Russians. Please, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think this this confusion can be cleared up pretty simply by recalling what we were discussing earlier, that all of these words, Nazi, communist, socialist, revolutionary, right-wing, left-wing, Republican, that they mean nothing. And it's because those words really don't mean anything is that we have this discussion going on. Well, did they bring the Nazis over? Or, well, they brought the men who were Nazis over, but what does Nazi mean? We don't know. What it means is they're collectivists. Nazis, the Nazism is merely one version or one manifestation of collectivism. Communism is merely another one. We have the deep state in the side, which is another one. There are collectivists around the world that have different labels on them, but they all believe the same. And by the time World War II was finished, our government was loaded with collectivists. And the idea of collectivism was sold to the American people as necessary to put on a successful war so that we could win the battle against Nazism and fascism. Little did we know that we were building Nazism and fascism in our own country in the name of fighting Nazism and fascism. We didn't call it that, but the principles were the same. It's collectivism. So when it came time to bring the Nazis, the former Nazis, now they're not Nazis anymore because the war's over, right? The Nazi party's gone, so they're former Nazis. So we bring the former Nazis over. Who's bringing them over? Well, government agencies, so-called intelligence agencies, which were loaded with collectivists. They saw these people as their brothers.
Yeah.
They believe the same thing. We can use these guys on our team. It was like, you know, two basketball teams playing each other. And they represent two teams, but they both play the same game. And they, when it comes time to find a new member of the team, they say, gee, this guy, I remember from another team, he beat the pants off of us. He's a good guy. He was on the other team, but we need him on our team now. So that's the same thing. They'll take the basketball players from the Nazi team and put them on the American team. And they say, well, they're not Nazi players anymore. Now they're Americans. And so the short answer, I have to say it again, is they believe the same thing. They are the same people under the skin. And whether it's communism or fascism or Nazism, it's all the same. So there was no conflict there at all. It was just a question of keeping the American people from knowing that these guys have all got wardrobes hidden somewhere in a trunk with a swastika on the shoulder. That's the only thing that they had to worry about. Wernher von Braun was a classic example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Mele, I'm sorry, buddy. We're so close to the end, and I want to make sure we get the last three callers, so we got to bounce. But excellent question. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Zach.
All right, talk to you soon, man.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Yeah, this was awesome.
Have a great night. All right, next caller. Please, guys, if you're not on the line yet, don't jump into the call. I'm going to take these three callers, but if anybody else jumps on, we're not going to. Caller, you're on the air. Can we get a name? Make sure you mute that stream.
Yeah, this is Val Hall. Sorry, stream's still going now. Hi, Zach.
Hi. What's your question for Mr. Griffin? Yeah, we've got you. You're live.
Well, I just want to say hi to G. Edward Griffin because he's one of my greatest heroes because I gave up my regular life about 20 years ago to fight chemtrails and geoengineering. And G. Edward Griffin being in the movie, What in the World Are They Spraying?
Oh, yes.
Really had an impact on me. And just to tell you, Mr. Griffin, you're one of my absolute greatest heroes. I took a stand and stood up for 20 years with some of the greatest activists in the world and became one of them worldwide, trying to stop the aerosols from being sprayed. And you were just instrumental in the fight that I tried to get. And it's funny that you brought up the plandemic and the way that kind of put a block in everything, because somebody that was fighting UN Agenda 21 and the aerosols and the fluoride and all this, people that I worked with all over the world, all of a sudden we had like a brick wall because there was this new, pandemic of a crazy cold or whatever. But what I really wanted to say more than that is just, wow, so great to even call in and say hi to you. You're one of my greatest heroes. So I can't hear anything yet because I'm talking, I guess. But
I'll put up my hand and say thank you, thank you. I appreciate that so much.
And the people, like you said, I worked with some of the greatest activists in the world, and a lot of them are no longer alive, which is a crazy thing, but people that speak the truth and fight for it hard are often eliminated. So I just wanted to call and say, oh my God, I can just even say hi to Edward G. Griffin.
Well, that's very kind of you, my dear. I'm going to make a suggestion. What part of the world do you live in?
I'm in California.
Well, we have a Red Pill Expo coming up at the end of this month. Not the end, but the beginning, November 12 and 13 in Salt Lake. You might want to come out there, and I'll shake your hand. I'd love to meet you in person. So,
all right.
Look us up.
I hope that Zach will give me a link to that.
It's in the description of the video. So I believe it's redpillexpo.org, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, hold on. I got it.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. Redpillexpo.org.
Yeah, you'll see all about it.
Thank you. And it's so funny. I had to wait a long time to even say anything and do stuff around the house. But all I wanted to say is I love you, G. Edward Griffin. You're one of my greatest heroes. Thank you for always standing up for what's right. And when Zach was going to have you on the show, I was like, I don't want to miss that. So
You're an
amazing man and a brilliant mind. And thank you for standing up for humanity.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your kind words. And I appreciate your calling in. And hopefully we'll see you at the expo.
I hope so.
All right. Have a great night. Thank you for your work as well. All right. Next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Can we get a name?
Carrie.
Carrie, welcome to the program. What's your question for G. Edward Griffin?
Two questions. And I like your talk about the future. And thank you so much, Mr. Griffin. You've been a trailblazer in my time. Your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, just bent my mind around, which is exactly what I needed. But my question is about the future and rewriting the Constitution for the world, as you say. On the judiciary end, would you include a provision that once the Supreme Court has ruled on an issue, if a governor enacts a law that goes against what SCOTUS has ruled, that law is defunct and that the governor who signed that goes to jail automatically? Because that'd be great, like we see with New York doing with the Second Amendment laws. And secondly, I want to know your take on what's going on with Brazil's election. Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. What is going on with what election? I missed that last
Brazil. Oh, Brazil.
Brazil.
Oh, Brazil. Well, I'll start with that one because I don't really know. I haven't studied that. I don't have enough data on that one. But it's very impressive. That's all I can say. But I have learned not to form an opinion too quickly until I see who the players are and what they're advocating and so forth. But so I'll just start off by saying I don't really have an answer to that one, except I'm going to study it. But now the other question about, if I understand it correctly, is if a governor violates or issues an edict of some kind contrary to ruling of the Supreme Court, it depends on what the ruling is, I suppose. If the ruling was dependent on something in the federal constitution itself that the federal government had the authority to determine, then I would say that the governor must be free to reject it. I don't know about putting him in prison. But the point is, the heavy point here is that I still believe a strict reading of the constitution is that the states are supreme. They're independent governments. We are united states, but we are still states. And by that, I don't mean subdivisions of the federal government. I mean they are superior to the federal government. They are the originators of the federal government. So on that basis, the governors can do pretty much anything they want to do. To heck with the Supreme Court of the federal government, unless it's something that they have agreed to abide to. The states have agreed to abide to a certain provision in the federal government. And that's where the Constitution comes in. As you know, that almost all of those provisions are restrictions on the federal government. They're directions for what the government can and cannot do. The federal government has very little to do with what the states can do because they're supreme over the federal government, as in the original concept. So the short answer to your question is, having said something about those two issues, I would be very careful to make sure that the rights of the states and therefore the right of the governor of the states would not be limited by any provision that I might come up with.
Good to know.
All right.
Good to know.
Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. All right. And final caller of the night, Thumper Rose. Bringing her in, and actually, you know, I don't know that it's a woman, but for some reason it occurred to me that they were. And then we've got a couple of thank yous over on Rumble. Lunar Hayes said, I love you, RP. I'll catch this vid on replay. Keep up the great work, and I love what you're doing with Badlands Media, too. Thank you very much. Don't forget, you can catch me on Badlands Media on Mondays and Wednesdays. And Original Clag says, good evening, Zach and Mr. Griffin. Big fan, sir. Thank you very much for that. Thumper, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm almost spellbound. My grandfather and I used to sit around the table and have discussions, and he had a library at his house of 20,000 books, and we would go over stuff, and he said, you know, it's good. I love it that you're such an intelligent girl, but you're a girl in the day. You know what that meant? I was like, I always felt ashamed that I didn't have a penis and I couldn't go to college. I'm sorry.
Oh, well,
I grew up and went to college. Anyway, a lot of this stuff, I hear everybody say, oh, the forefathers were Mason, they were Illuminati and stuff. But if you read their writings, they told us all of this. They told us, we're giving you a constitutional republic if you can keep it. And we're giving you this form of government. And as soon as you blink, all these people in government are going to become wolves, and they're going to have you for dinner. So stay awake and stay alert. And what did we do? We got fat and happy.
It's true.
Yeah. And it's just that, and I'm loving these new, like Mr. Griffin, coming out and saying, hey, you know, this is what we need to do. And I'm not a revolutionaryist or a revolter, but I'm a, you know, let's install the rule of law. And I don't really have a question. I'm just fanboying. And I was in chat and everybody's like, you should call. And I was like, oh, I don't even know how I have graduated from boomer to zoomer.
There you go.
And it is so good to see you, Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Thumper. My pleasure.
All right. Thumper, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. And I'm glad you're enjoying the show.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Have a great night. Okay, you guys, we're at the end of the broadcast. Let me just give the final thank yous over on the Foxhole. Sean Joe said, Mr. Griffin, you have made a difference in moving the human condition forward. God bless you. Tanette Booth just activated a bronze tier subscription. Thank you very much. Homegoy says, great guest. G. Edward was instrumental in my red pill shift. Thank you to Puddin' Hollow for 1, 2, 3, 4 cookies. Timberjet says, thank you, Zach, for another fine program. I missed the first part because of the Trump rally, which was epic. Yes, at the time that we scheduled this, the Trump rally wasn't scheduled, and I was already having G. Edward Griffin stay up pretty late for the show, so I didn't want to push it any farther. Cubanon, thank you for the ship. Low Country Brooklyn says, don't forget redpillexpo.org. Porpoiseful says, this is one of the best shows yet. Thank you. Brooklyn also says, follow this amazing individualist on Truth. G. Edward Griffin is on Truth Social. You can find him at G. Edward underscore Griffin. Brooklyn also says, shout out to the Foxhole fam and to the team for what they've done for the community. We are grateful. Woken Walked says, shout out to Thumper Rose. Brooklyn also says, shout out to three of my favorite Patriot mothers, Thumper Rose, Debbie Roush, and Rain. Love you all. And then 123SKG got a silver subscription. Thank you very much for the support, you guys. Also, real briefly, over on Cash App, Catherine says, great show for tonight. Loving the conversation. And hello to this fine gentleman, G. Edward Griffin, and hi to my mom. Tracy says, much love always and great show today. And then Kelly says, I should try to get David Jose on Telegram on my show. He's actually on the list, so bet David Jose will be here before too long. And then finally, over there on Buy Me a Coffee, Kim says, I'm really enjoying following you on Rumble, RP. I do miss your shorter news shows, but enjoy your shows on Badlands Media, too. There will be more RPNs back on the air. I've just had so much going on. Mara also says, thank you, Zach. I'm a monthly supporter, but I thought I'd send you some love. Mr. Griffin, I just wanted to say one more time, thank you so much for being here. And at the conclusion of the broadcast, I always like to ask my guests what you would most like the audience to take away from our conversation tonight.
Most. I guess it would be the realization that the answer that we're looking for is within us. I think somebody said it quite well the other day. It sort of shook me. I think he said it this way. He said, the people we have been looking for to save us are us.
Absolutely.
That's the thought, because there's the lever that makes it all happen. If we are looking for someone else to do it, think, oh, we're too busy, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough time, I don't have enough knowledge, I don't like getting busy with politics or anything, then, you know, nothing's going to happen. But it's within all of us to do something. And I think when all of us add our something together, it'll be something great.
Amen. All right. Coming up on, you said it was November, was it 11th and 12th or 12th and 13th for the Red Pill Expo?
12th and 13th, yes, in Salt Lake City. Yes, everybody, please take a look at the Red Pill Expo. You're going to like it.
All right. Excellent. Thank you once more to everyone for hanging out with us tonight. Thank you again to G. Edward Griffin for taking the time to spend these last few hours with us. And everybody, I'll be off tomorrow because it's Sunday, but I'll be back on Monday. And until that time, good luck and God bless. Did you have something else, Ed?
Yeah. My wife has just told me I forgot to add .org when I said go to Red Pill Expo. Right. She's always correct on that. I always forget it. So if you want to find out the truth about Red Pill Expo and everything else in the world, it's redpillexpo.org.
Excellent. And of course, once more, all of that and a number of other websites for Mr. Griffin are in the description of this video. If you didn't catch the whole thing, you can watch the replay shortly, and the audio podcast will be out later tonight. So everybody at home, good luck and God bless.